Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Who was America's best president and who was the worst? For decades, historians have tried to rank or grade the men who have sat in the Oval Office. The public affairs cable TV network C-SPAN has conducted their historian survey on presidential leadership after the last three elections to rank the nation's chief executives. During the network's 40 years, C-SPAN has featured interviews with dozens of historians about the presidents. Those interviews and rankings have been compiled into a new book called The Presidents. C-SPAN founder and chairman Brian Lamb and C-SPAN co-CEO Susan Swain recently appeared at Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg to discuss the book and the presidents. So this is not the first book that C-SPAN has put out. Why this one? What was the idea behind The Presidents?
Well, this is C-SPAN's 40th anniversary. It was started back in 1979 when our House of Representatives first went on camera. And we were thinking about how we could celebrate or mark our 40th anniversary in a way that was substantive. And about a year and a half ago, I went to Brian and said that we had done the collections of interviews before, but we'd never done one that got many of his interviews with presidential historians all in one place. So we took that to our publisher, Public Affairs Press in New York City, and we also decided not to do this book chronologically, but as you mentioned, to bring in another resource, which is our three times over 20 years survey of presidential historians' rankings of the presidents, and we organized this book by how the presidents fared in the 2017 ranking.
And just to let everyone know, if you haven't read the book yet, it is not chronological.
No, absolutely.
It is the presidents are ranked from 1 to 44. Notice 45 is not yet ranked. We'll talk about that a little bit later. We're not going to anticipate where that ranking will go, but 1 through 44. Why rank the presidents? Why do it that way?
Well, one thing we need to point out in the beginning is that there is no correlation between the ranking and the chapters. And some people pick it up expecting the chapters to reflect where that president is. It's a slice of life from these interviews that have been done over the last 30 years. Why rank the presidents? Susan, why rank the presidents?
Well, it's actually something that's been done since 1948. Dr. Schlesinger Sr. first had the idea to put together a ranking of presidential historians, and he got mailbags and mailbags full of comments of people who wanted to debate his rankings and knew that he was onto something, because putting presidents in order by how they succeeded in office gives us, the citizens, something to talk about. And what better thing if you're in the business that we're in, journalism, or you're a historian, than to find a tool that engages people. And ranking the president certainly does that. I'm sure if you look across our rankings, you will have a bone to pick with several of them. And what that does is stimulate conversation and learning as a result of that. And really, that's why we started ranking them. We did the first one in 2000. We had just finished a year-long live television production where we went on location to a historic site associated with every single president. When we were finished, we had all of these wonderful anecdotal stories by historians and biographers, and we felt like we wanted to put a capper on it some way. So we went to the three historians that we have put on the cover here. And you probably, if you follow the news, have heard some of these names before. Richard Norton Smith, who's frequently on PBS. Edna Green Medford may not be as familiar. She's at Howard University, historically black college in Washington, D.C., and she's the Dean of Humanities there now. She's a specialist on the Reconstruction era of United States history. And Douglas Brinkley, whom you often will see as a commentator on MSNBC. And also a gentleman who's standing right in the doorway back there, Dr. John Splane from the University of Maryland. And together, we argued over what kind of metrics we might use to judge a presidency. The historians, of course, won. I mean, we were able to add some thoughts to it, but we really relied on their expertise, and did the first one in 2000 just as Bill Clinton was coming out of office. And again, just like Schlesinger had found in 1948, it got a lot of attention and a lot of people talking. So we decided every time a president leaves office, we would do another. And so we've done three.
Americans love lists.
We do love lists.
Maybe it does have something to do with being able to argue, and it does get people thinking, which is a good thing. I think it's interesting, too, when you say that these rankings are based on a blend of characteristics. I mean, when you said moral authority, one of the first names that popped in my head was Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter, I don't think anyone would question his moral authority, but wasn't a great president.
Right.
Now, I think you have him down to just 26 this time, and we'll talk more about that President Carter in just a moment. When I told people that I would be having this conversation with you today, I had five or six people probably ask the same three questions, or one question with three different, looking for three different answers. Who was first? Who was last? What about Trump? So let's take those questions. I don't think number one is a big surprise. Abraham Lincoln is rated number one, and he has 907 points. You talked about the criteria that you used, but there were numbers placed with those 10 different categories. So Lincoln got 907 points. Why Abraham Lincoln?
Let me first say that we, C-SPAN, didn't judge these people, whether they were good, bad, or indifferent. It was a group of historians, journalist historians, tried to balance it out a little bit as best we could politically. And they, every time, come up with Abraham Lincoln. I think they're probably, first of all, he wrote more than probably any president in history. And those that follow him closely think he wrote as well as anybody ever has written. There are so many. There are probably 500 people that make their living off of Abraham Lincoln on a daily basis, more than any other president. And he had a war, a very, very important war that you all know about. And we know a lot about it. And it's talked about still every day, how important it was. He also was assassinated. And he was the first of our four presidents that had been assassinated. All that combines to make him number one. And he had the worst president before him and the second worst president after him. So it's a little package deal.
I think it's interesting, too, that, and this is in the book, you talked about how much Lincoln wrote and used the telegraph system to get his message out and write letters. If Twitter would have existed in the 1860s, Abraham Lincoln may have been the first president to tweet every day.
Sure. Presidents have always been very good at adopting new technologies. We were talking about Calvin Coolidge just the other day. You want to tell the Coolidge story with radio?
Well, Coolidge was really the first president in history to use radio. And he did 22 speeches on radio when he was president. And he gets a... There's a certain kind of a cliche rap he gets today about being dull and uninteresting and all that stuff. It depends on where your politics are with Calvin Coolidge. Some people like the fact that he kept things down. He had a balanced budget. He didn't spend a lot of money that he didn't have. But he decided when the radio started, and there weren't many people that had radios. It's kind of like when we started. There were only 3 million people that got C-SPAN on day one, and it went all the way over the years up to 100 million. But Calvin Coolidge sounded on radio very authoritative, and people liked his voice. And today, looking back on it, we wouldn't have no idea what he really sounded like, certainly in the context of our day. And you can go through the years and pick out every time technology changed, and presidents, politicians, better able to get to people in the country, changed as when television came on. The thing that people my age, and there aren't many here that are my age or older, our president, our first president that I saw on television, Eisenhower, and then the second one, John F. Kennedy, were black and white. And you don't think about it today. I mean, when John F. Kennedy was assassinated, those four unbelievably difficult days were all in black and white. And then about the middle of the 60s, it turned into color. And it made a difference. And when Lyndon Johnson quit on March 30th, 1968, said he wouldn't run again, take the nomination, it was in color. And you can just go on through and look at the technology And when it changes, presidential communications changes.
But again, I think that most historians, almost all historians, and even regular people who aren't historians but follow history, would agree that Lincoln is at the top.
Every single survey.
What in particular made him the best?
Well, it's moral authority is very strong, and also how much he grew in office in a very short time as the crucible of war came upon him, and also the fact that he had excellent communication skills. So you combine the fact that he, unlike the several presidents before him, as the strains of the sectionalism in this country were getting worse and worse, and it was clearly heading towards war, he was the one who said, we're going to fight this war and we're going to win it. Whereas the two people on either side of him kind of were whistling past the graveyard, quite literally. So the fact that he took this on as a moral cause and figured out a way to win this war and save the nation, I mean, what else would we give him except the number one spot? George Washington, number two all the time. He and in Lincoln, in our survey and in most of them, have the highest ranking, one and two all the way across. But Washington, like almost every one of the founders, except for John Adams, they lose in the one category that we have is pursued equal justice for all. He ranks 13th in that, and you could argue even lower, but you cannot get past that. If you've been to Mount Vernon in Virginia, they've done a really excellent job of capturing that whole side of the Washington family story and bringing that to life there, because that plantation would not have been a success, without the enslaved labor that worked the plantation, and that is very much also a part of George Washington's history.
How do you, and when I say you, I don't mean the two of you, but the historians, compare, say, Washington and Lincoln, even, we're talking, 80 years apart.
Right.
There were big changes in this country during those 80 years. So how do you make comparisons when there's so much, the country has changed so much, the office has changed so much?
Well, you could say the same thing about comparing presidents at the end of the 20th century to the presidents we have today.
Right.
The office of the presidency, this country, continues to evolve enormously. The challenges that they face, as soon as the nuclear age arrived, that office became very much more important than it had ever been before because of the ability to put your finger on that button. None of the early presidents, no matter how many wars they faced, had the possibility to destroy mankind with the push of a button. So it is kind of a parlor game, and we understand that, to compare modern-day presidents to the presidents of old. But in fact, if you look at the leadership skills, the important thing is we also ask people in the context of the times in which they served, and that is also one of the 10 metrics. So what we're looking for here is to learn about history, and we are also looking to say, what are the qualities of people who have helped advance this country over time, and who were the placeholders?
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guests are Brian Lamb, the founder and chairman of the cable TV network C-SPAN, and Susan Swain, the co-CEO of C-SPAN, talking about their new book, The Presidents. Lamb and Swain recently appeared at Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg.
Okay, so it's no surprise we've already given away the answer to the question.
I think you knew as Pennsylvanians,
yeah, I think so,
right?
Too.
Yeah.
While Lincoln is universally number one, James Buchanan is universally the number 44 on this list. I think you touched on it. A big thing in the chapter on James Buchanan is that he could not make a decision. He was a waffler. What is it? I mean, when you look at James Buchanan's background, his resume, he may have been the best prepared person we have ever had going into office. I mean, the guy was ambassador to England. He was a Pennsylvania state representative.
Secretary of State.
Secretary of State, a congressman, U.S. senator, was ambassador to Russia, I believe, too. But, the guy had a great resume. Why couldn't he make a decision? What was the problem?
Brian?
I'm not talking about the Pennsylvanian. That's yours.
Oh, come on. Yeah, you're great. Safe now.
Yeah, it's okay. Go ahead.
Well, there are two things to add to President Buchanan. By the way, a lot of these presidents out of the 44 men that have been president were very well prepared, especially in the early days. They all were secretaries of state. They were ambassadors. They were ministers to Russia, Great Britain, and all that. They negotiated treaties. But in the he got hit with two things besides being indecisive. Dred Scott decision came during the time that he was president, which was a horrible decision. Almost everybody agrees today.
Maybe the worst ever.
Maybe the worst ever. It's what it said, that the historian said in the book. The other thing was the panic of 1857 and the money. It's almost always about the money. Very few presidents that have problems financially do well. Either if it hits while they're there and they can't improve it, that's gonna make it difficult for them to be highly ranked. If they get it bad when they're there and then it's heading up when they're when their time is over, that won't hurt them so much. But the money is so very critical in all this stuff. And if they have a war, that also changes everything. Some of these presidents on these lists had wars, got out of them, and that was a great benefit.
Buchanan, when you get the cliff note on Buchanan, it almost is always his waffling, if they use that word, indecisiveness led to the Civil War. Very few talk about the money, 1857. So you have to kind of look at the administration overall to find out how he got his ranking.
Robert Strauss tells this story that James Buchanan's great idea for dealing with the economic panic was to make coins smaller.
Yeah.
Use less metal, I guess. I mean, that really inventive, huh? Didn't help very much.
Hey, I love some of the anecdotes in the book. John Kennedy, I guess he was criticizing someone or asking someone about presidential rankings. And he said, it's not fair unless you sat behind this desk and all the issues that you've had to deal with. But he also said, I don't think it's fair that you put people down there with poor James Buchanan. In a backhanded way, even Kennedy was saying that Buchanan was ranked lower than anyone else.
Yeah. I'm sorry about that, Pennsylvania. There's still time.
All right. So let's go back to the top five. We talked about Lincoln, number one, Washington, number two, Franklin Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt, and Dwight Eisenhower. We're going to talk about Eisenhower in just a moment, but why those other three in the top five?
Go ahead, Brian.
It's obvious, I think. FDR is FDR, and almost you can hear Republicans and Democrats today on most of those top presidents of giving them their due, no matter what party they were in. World War II, the way he got us through all that, is number one on the list. He again was faced with a terrible economic situation, and it took a long time, frankly, and a lot of people think it took a war, but they got out of it, and he came up with all the innovative ideas that put people back to work, put money in people's pockets, a chicken in every pot. I can go on. But and Theodore Roosevelt was, I think, and we've got some folks here I know that just spent some time out at Yosemite. Anybody that likes these national parks, give full credit to Theodore Roosevelt. He captured the land. And we now have these terrific national parks. That was part of it. And then when you get to Eisenhower, again, World War II, as many of you in this room know, because you're as expert on this as anybody, Harry Truman said, I would be your vice president if you would run for president on the Democratic ticket. He thought he was a Democrat. And I think he was quite shocked when it turned out that he at least for the time that he ran, he was a Republican. And they didn't get along terribly well till late in their years and didn't get back together until the Kennedy funeral. So the Eisenhower, it's just fairly obvious with those first five, and it gets harder and harder when you get down that list, depending on your... A lot of it's today, I think, is they're the ones in the top 10 are mostly the newer presidents, except for George Washington and Abraham Lincoln.
But there is... I don't know, asterisk next to Eisenhower's name to a degree, in that he has moved up from your previous surveys. I mean, he was 8, 10, maybe even in the double digits, but now number five. What changed in the eyes of historians about Dwight Eisenhower?
Well, many of you have probably heard the hidden hand theory that is becoming very popular about Dwight Eisenhower. He was looked upon and actually criticized by John Kennedy when he was running for president about having a very, well, we would use their term laid back, but uninvolved presidency, golfing while the Cold War was raging between our country and the Soviet Union. Now historians are beginning to believe, by spending more time with his writings, that it was very much a studied attitude to keep the Soviets at bay, that he was not concerned about the race that was going on between the two countries, while at the same time very much involved in fighting the Cold War on behalf of the United States. What I loved about the biography that we have of Eisenhower in here, which is interesting contrast with the leadership style of our current president, Dwight Eisenhower said, and this is his military backing, planning is everything. Planning is everything. Plans are worthless, but planning is everything. And he, every week, met with his National Security Council. He held press conferences every single week to talk to the press. He ran a very organized and systematic government and was in control of it, very much in contrast to the duffer that we see out on the golf course. And it's interesting to think that that was a studied position on his part, like feigning the enemy, as he might do on the battlefield.
Well, Pennsylvania claims Eisenhower.
You bet.
To a degree, too, with his,
you can
his
have
home
him.
In Gettysburg.
Gettysburg's wonderful.
That's right. Looking at the other side, a president who has fallen in rankings over the years. Andrew Jackson. What happened with Andrew Jackson?
I think a great deal of it is what we're seeing happen all over the country right now, right or wrong, that his past is catching up with him. It's a present day reaction to what happened back in those days with the Trail of Tears. He was not a very pleasant man. At one point, the Democrats in this country thought he was the greatest thing that ever happened. They had the Jackson dinners, Jefferson-Jackson dinners, and they're running away from that in many cases. Everybody claims Lincoln. Everybody claims FDR and George Washington. So it's I think it's part of the time. He was not a very friendly person. He won militarily. But I have to say, it's all in the eye of the beholder. Sitting here talking about these guys, it worries me that we think we know what we're talking about. we don't know any more about these presidents than what's in this book or people we've interviewed. We're not historians. You all have just as much insight as we do. Our opinions don't matter so much in this as much as the ability for us to read what these historians have uncovered. And the reason I mention that is because we're sitting in this fabulous bookstore, and this is also a tribute, as all of these books have been, to authors. I am not an author. Susan was the person that edited this book. All I did was read the books and interview the people in the book, and that's a fabulous experience. It's the best experience. But these people that did all this work spent years finding this information, and they don't get nearly enough credit in our society. Right now, we're giving a lot of credit to Bob Carroll for what the fabulous work he's done with Lyndon Johnson, but there's a lot of authors that do every bit as much as he's done on Lyndon Johnson, on other presidents, and that's the reason why we're doing this stuff.
When you're talking about autobiographies, and I don't know personally whether this president's ranking has moved or not, but Ulysses Grant, yeah. Everyone talks about his autobiography as being the best presidential autobiography. Right. And you kind of can sense, whether it's from historians or not, that people think differently about Grant, because it used to be that, oh, the Grant administration had so much corruption and was a weak president, not a good president. And that's kind of changed nowadays.
He's moved more than any president up in our survey, 11 points. And Ron Chernow's biography is another contributing factor to that, because we're thinking about him and revisiting some of the things that we knew about him. Hey, I wanted to mention one thing about the Obama thing that talks about this book and what to expect if you read it. Again, the rankings are one thing. The chapters are drawn from Brian's interview. The interview that we have for President Obama was done by a man named Garrow, and he won the Pulitzer Prize for his biography of Martin Luther King. the Obama administration was cooperating with him. And in fact, he had how many hours, Brian, with President Obama?
10.
10 in the White House, and was able even to review some of what he had written with the president. In the end, the Obamas were not happy with his book because it ended up, this man is a self-proclaimed very progressive. And like a number of progressives in society, was unhappy with the policies of the Obama administration. And he ends up in his epilogue being critical of President Obama as a progressive. So the administration went from cooperating to trying everything they could to not have people read the book as an authoritative voice. But it stands in juxtaposition to the rating of number 12 and the metrics. So what we want you to do is think about how historians as a group might have rated it and compare that with the narratives in the chapter, again, to stimulate your own thinking.
By the way, Scott, we mentioned U.S. Grant. You can go right over here to the table and find Elizabeth Sammet's book. It's a beautiful book. And the book is Grant's memoirs, and they're annotated not from a historical standpoint, but from a literary standpoint. Plus, Ronald White wrote a beautiful book on U.S. Grant. As Susan said, Ron Chernow, this seems to be catching on. And I don't know how these folks are selling all these books, but they're John Marzalek, who has the U.S. Grant Museum down at the Mississippi State University, also put out an annotated version from a historical standpoint. So there have been four very important Grant books within the last couple years.
When President Obama grants 10 hours of time to a biographer, he obviously cares about his legacy. Do presidents care about their legacy?
Oh.
I mean, do they care about these rankings?
Yeah.
I mean, let's face it, you have to have a thick skin to serve in that office. Would something like a ranking like this bother a president?
Susan?
Well,
we don't have to name names.
No, we won't name names, but
why not?
Well, you told us a story about being at Wheatland and having the folks that run the foundation not being happy about their guy being the last position all the time. I'd say last is a distinction, at least, than we're in the middle somewhere.
He's talked about more than anybody else.
Yeah, absolutely. So, of course, not only the presidents, but the libraries, the foundations that now exist to support these, they care a lot about how the public sees and views their presidency and work very hard to put them as much as possible in a good light. So, sure. I guess I'll tell you that we when we're going out talking about this book, we really didn't approach any of the libraries where people were in the middle and below because we thought it might be a bit awkward to say, well, you're number 28. Could we come talk about your presidency? So we recognized that by using this technique and putting the ratings in, that would be not as pleasant for some. We had one presidential library that didn't realize that they were in the position that they were and it had invited us and then asked us could we kindly take the numbers down and the ratings for the exhibit just because they thought their president should be named higher than they were. I'm not going to say the name, but.
This 6 through 10, Truman, Jefferson, Kennedy, Reagan, and Lyndon Johnson. Brian, you said that it seems as though a lot of recent presidents end up near the top. Truman, you know, Harry Truman is someone that didn't aspire to be president. I mean, vice president, I don't know if he aspired to be vice president, but an interesting guy. And again, someone that there's been a lot of interest in because of a biography. But what was it about Harry Truman that made him a great president or a near great president?
I think it's the full story of him going back to World War I when he actually fought in the war and was a leader. And as he came through his life, he led the Truman Commission after the World War II, which was very important to look into how the money was being spent. In addition to that, my favorite chapter in all of the history books that I've read is the last chapter in the Truman book that David McCullough wrote, because I think a lot of people in politics could take a lesson from what Truman did. He went home. He didn't speak for a living. He didn't have a pension. He didn't have Secret Service. If you go to Delaware Street, the house that he really never owned because it belonged to Bess Truman's parents, and you'll find a little tiny room there that he sat in the last 20 years of his life and read 2,000 books on the shelf. He would walk every day down to where the library was being built. And he did publish his memoir, which was successful, but otherwise he did not pop up out of a bed in a television commercial that one famous American politician did promoting the hotel chain a few years ago. And that started this process, which I think has been sad, that it's how much can I grab after I leave the presidency? And I think that that's one of the reasons. But he was decisive. He obviously, this is very controversial, but he dropped the bomb. And he had a terrible economy while he was there for a while. And his popularity when he left was either 23 or 24%. It's one of the great stories, comeback stories. And he didn't do anything to do it. I think everybody else looked at him and said, this guy knew how to make a decision.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guests are Brian Lamb, the founder and chairman of the cable TV network C-SPAN, and Susan Swain, the co-CEO of C-SPAN, talking about their new book, The Presidents. Lamb and Swain recently appeared at Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg.
Ronald Reagan. I was a little surprised to see that Reagan was ranked ninth. What about Reagan? Obviously, he was a great communicator, but what about Reagan? Why so high?
Yeah, he's the only modern president in the top 10.
Edmund Morris wrote a famous book called Dutch. Some of you may have read it. He got in a little bit of, I don't want to say he got into trouble, the book got into trouble, when he created a fictional character in the book, and nobody... Again, I shouldn't say nobody, but very few people liked it. But he did three books on Teddy Roosevelt. But the White House picked him after he asked to be the insider to watch Ronald Reagan up close, and he was invited to come to the White House once a month, and he would have 30 minutes with Ronald Reagan, mostly in the Oval Office. And after the whole thing was over, he couldn't get his hands around Ronald Reagan. I mean, I'm not about to try to tell you why Ronald Reagan's number nine. I don't know why he is, other than the fact that he was incredibly popular. Edmund Morris told the best story I've ever heard about Ronald Reagan, and that was near the end of his time when he was giving his farewell speech. They allowed Edmund Morris to come to the Oval Office and sit in and watch it. And he was just sitting over at the side. He didn't say anything. And I wish I could tell it like Edmund Morris does, but Ronald Reagan came in, he sat at the desk, and up on the sides so that he could see were television monitors. And he's sitting there just looking around at his papers and getting ready to deliver his address. And all of a sudden, they turned the monitors on. And he looked up and saw himself on the monitor and said, oh, there he is. You think that one through. That was Ronald Reagan right there on that television set, and he knew it. And Edmund Morris was there to hear it. So it will always, I think, be a mystery. You look back on it, if you don't like his politics, if you didn't like Iran-Contra, you can go through that process. But here was a man that was shot and survived, and that was a very important part of the process. And he could communicate. I mean, it always becomes a cliche after a while, but all of these presidents, once somebody starts writing, he was a great communicator, everybody needs to get into that game. I don't know whether he was or not, but he is number nine, and it wasn't us that put him there. There were these historians, and we'll see how that turns out.
Lou Cannon is the biographer. Lou Cannon was a journalist in California who covered him during his years as the governor of the state and his rise politically. And he went on to write five books about Ronald Reagan. And he says it's still a mystery to him, even after all of those years. And one quote that's in the book is from Tip O'Neill, who wrote about Ronald Reagan, that he'd seen the best and worst of Ronald Reagan in one day. It was the day the Challenger collapsed. We all remember that stirring speech that he gave to the nation. And he said, I think that's true, this is Lou Cannon, you often did see Ronald Reagan's best and worst close together, and Ronald Reagan's gifts often rescued Reagan from himself.
Number 10, we did mention LBJ, Lyndon Johnson, and how historians have kind of, the further away from the administration we've gotten, kind of changed the way they look at him. But talk a little bit more about that. I mean, Vietnam obviously was a huge factor in Johnson, but why, he's ranked 10th now. And a lot of, as you said, that there have been, Brian, there's been a lot of written about Lyndon Johnson here in recent years. But what is it about Lyndon Johnson that people have taken a second and third look?
Lyndon Johnson's the only one I can talk about from a personal experience. When I was in the Navy in Washington, they had a collateral duty that you could get if you applied, and I don't, to this day, don't know why I did, but I was single and had time on my hands and became a social aide in the White House. All we had to do was have permission of our, I was over in the Pentagon, have permission of the person that we worked for to be able to get away from time to time during the daytime. And so we get a call, I'd have to go to the White House. And for those 2 years that I was there, I often was told that I was the introducer. So I would stand next to him while people coming to the receiving line would give me their name, and then I would say Susan Swain, and he didn't have to worry about remembering somebody's name. So I physically stood next to him for 2 years. He totally ignored me. but you can bet I was observing. He was a big man. He was 6'3", but he was a big man, and he was in people's face. He grabbed them, shook their hand, put his hand on their shoulder, backed them down. As a matter of fact, you've seen these pictures of people are being backed down by Lyndon Johnson. He knew, here was the trick of Lyndon Johnson. He knew every member of Congress. He knew their wives. He could call them by name. We have the greatest resource, everybody does, that for civics learning, and that is the Oval Office conversations. There have been something like 10,000 of them. We've put them all on our radio station over the last 20 years, and you can find them on our website or go straight to the LBJ Library. If you go to the library, they say that he had 1,000 domestic policy issues that he got passed. Those are the people that love him. Then you've got the 58,000 people that were killed in Vietnam. Those are the people that won't forgive him. Take your pick. He still had such a major impact on the United States. And, you know, as I look back, I mean, I had the experience of being around him. And I just realized what an incredibly big personality he was. And he would literally, in the receiving line, do business. I remember one night, he turned to me or somebody, and he said, "I want to go to Texas, get the plane." Now, they had not planned on that. He, by the way, had an airstrip built right at his ranch in the backyard there, so he could jump on a jet out at Andrews Air Force Base and fly down there and be there in a couple hours. And that's the way he operated his presidency all the time. I think it got him in trouble. I think that's partially, he admitted that we could not win the war in Vietnam. And Robert Carroll is going to do the last of 5 books. He's now got this very successful book out called Working. And he still hasn't gone to Vietnam. He says he's going to go there and spend a couple months so he can get the feeling of the war part of it. And he is yet to make his own mind up as to how he comes down in the long run. So the next couple years, Robert Carroll's 6 years older than I am, which makes him 83. And whenever I interview him, I always ask him about that. He's not terribly touchy about it, but he says it's the final copy of the book is years away, which, good luck. I wish him, seriously, because it'll be fun to find out what his conclusions are. But even if, no matter what he concludes, Johnson's a big man in history.
Now, Robert Carroll is the featured biographer in this book, of course. Brian has interviewed him several times. There is one scene that's included in here that I can visualize. So the Kennedys, although he was selected as a vice president, it was probably a big mistake, ultimately, for Johnson to think he could have power in that position, coming from Senate Majority Leader, where he had all the power, to the vice presidency, where the Kennedys actually worked to keep him down. One of the ways that they did it, which Kara tells, is that he had to get every one of his trips approved in advance by Robert Kennedy. The spending. And they would send him away on trips when there were critical things like Bay of Pigs going on in Washington, so he couldn't be near any of this.
However, when Lyndon Johnson became president, Hubert Humphrey had to get every one of his trips approved by Lyndon Johnson.
You know.
And he was bitter about it because he wouldn't let him fly overseas. He let him fly overseas on a jet. He wouldn't let him fly on a jet in the United States, really cramped his style.
So let me just, this one story that stayed with me that he told was that Johnson, the big man, was also a bit of a shuffler. And carried himself, and the Kennedys actually had pejorative nicknames for him, as a Southerner and with his accent and the like. But what he says is that on that airplane back from Dallas, he knew he had to walk off that plane and convince the world that he was able to be the leader, and his entire posture changed. Now, those of you who are alive or if you watch the video, you can actually remember him standing up in front of those microphones, carrying himself as he walked across the tarmac with that stance. Another person that I can remember changing their physical stance was Bill Clinton over the time he was in office. You look at the very early, during his campaign, and by the time he was in office for a year or so, he carried himself differently. That posture projects leadership out into the world, and I was fascinated that Johnson understood that on one plane ride and found that within himself to project that when he got down the steps of that plane.
William Henry Harrison.
Oh, boy. Okay.
Yeah, we're going to the back end now. William Henry Harrison died after a month in office. Probably heard the famous story about being cold on Inauguration Day, and he went out there without a coat on. Anyway, died a month into office. But yet, William Henry Harrison still ranks ahead of John Tyler, Warren G. Harding, Franklin Pierce, Andrew Johnson, and, of course, James Buchanan.
I know, I love it.
So does that say something about William Henry Harrison or those other guys?
The other presidents. So if you think about it, one of our historians said all the other presidents were net negative. So it's fascinating. So here's how the survey was conducted. The 100 historians, if they did not know anything about that president, they could choose not to answer. And about 31 actually answered the category for William Henry Harrison and were something of an expert on that era. So what of course he didn't have much to do in that month, but he came into office having the first modern presidential campaign. You've heard the expression Tippecanoe and Tyler too. He started sloganeering in presidential campaigns. He created a log cabin because he was famous for that and paraded it through the streets and had thousands of people come out and watch his campaign speeches. So that carried into the assessment of him as president, that whole campaign period. Plus, he was an incredible success as a military leader and brought that to the office as well. So I'm sure that played into some of the evaluations.
In that time period, that was very important for voters.
The fact that I'm from Tippecanoe County, Indiana, where this...
All politics is local.
All politics is local. Plus, he was the governor of the Indiana Territory, successful general. All of that had to play into it, but it was probably the Indiana connection more than anything that allowed him to play ahead of the rest of these.
All right, so as I mentioned very early on, that the third part of that question was, what about Trump, President Trump? He's not in these rankings, but there is a chapter on the president. Now, the book, you went to the book just came out last week to the public, but went to print, beginning
November,
of this year?
November.
November, okay. So we had roughly 2 years of the Trump administration. So that conversation, I mean, just like everything with this administration, I think one of the historians said that this presidency is unprecedented. Summarize, if you would, what they decided, what they wrote about the current president.
Don't look at me.
Well, we asked our three historians that wrote separate essays in the book and also have separate chapters to sit around and talk about what the atmospherics are around the election of Donald Trump. And this doesn't sound like it's kind to the, our historians. They didn't tell us anything that you don't already know. And so I don't, you know, we just felt very strongly that because he's still in office, that we shouldn't even think about putting him in the survey. And until he leaves office, he won't be in a survey, and we don't know when that's going to be. But I promise you that your current emotions about what you think of him for or against are not necessarily going to be where he fits in the survey, because we have 10 categories, and if economics are good, you can't put him down at number 44. So if they're being honest about it, you can't automatically assume he's going to be number 44, 45 on the list. Cleveland was president twice, 22nd and 24th. That's how you get the number 45. I just waffled in case you didn't
know. It was your best James Buchanan imitation.
Yeah.
But some of the things that were mentioned in that chapter, the way the President Trump, when we talked about it being unprecedented, the way he dominates the news cycle, let's face it, every president is at the top of the news every night on the network newscast, 24 hours a day with 24-hour news. But Donald Trump drives that conversation, that narrative, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's a master at it, if you think about it. And this use of Twitter is going to be something that, well, politicians will continue to emulate. We talked before about someone, a new technology coming in, and first maybe politicians are thinking, I'm really becoming criticized by this, and then if you're successful, you figure out how to take it over and use it to your best advantage. He certainly has. And it's also, I mean, we work in the cable industry, the 24-hour news channels, and their insatiable need to constantly have news stories is a part of this generation of presidents. And he fills that vacuum very nicely. So it's a combination of technology changing as well as someone coming in and figuring out how to master that technology to their best advantage.
It all started with the O.J. Simpson trial. Think about that and then move forward, and you'll see why what's happening is happening.
Explain what you mean by that.
O.J. Simpson trial went on for 9 months. CNN saw it as an opportunity to bump their ratings up, and it was very successful. If you haven't noticed, there you got two networks that are prosecuting Donald Trump every minute of every day. They want to obviously run him out of office, and one that does not. The one that does not gets heavily criticized for even being in the business, which I find fascinating, because the other two, I've never seen anything like it, where when I get up and turn on my television set, Fox is ignoring most of the time things that are going on in the Trump administration unless he's talking to them, and the other two are prosecuting him on a day-to-day, hour-to-hour basis, no matter what it is in the New York Times or the Washington Post, they're talking about it. This is not what I thought was news when I grew up in this business. It's a form of news, but it's very financially successful, period. I won't say any more.
The takeaway for the book. What do you want the people who read the book to take away?
I would just say it's very simple. I hope people that don't know all that much about presidents or the country just dip into it and enjoy these historians. I can't believe how little I know, in spite of the fact that I interviewed these people. I've read these chapters 3 times at a minimum. I've studied what they say. It's just so much to the history of this country, and we're not even that old, that I just hope somebody uses it as a primer to get into this stuff. And it's just, it's fun, it's interesting, and it's also important for young people as we go to the next generation. And as you all know, they're not doing as much history now as they used to, at least when I was growing up. And that's why we do this. We are not, as a company or an individual, making any money off of this, just the publisher. So help the publisher.
Well, any royalties from this book we're putting in the C-SPAN Education Foundation, which gives free teaching materials to middle and high school teachers. That's what really motivates us. I think we think of ourselves and our work at C-SPAN as educators, and that's what we want this book to be. What we wanted to do with this was make history so approachable. The chapters are really conversational, and since each one is a self-contained story, you can put it down and pick it up 2 weeks later and not have lost the narrative thread because they are self-contained. So that was really our goal, is to interest people in learning more about this great country that we live in.
Brian Lamb, Susan Swain, thank you very much for being here in Harrisburg today, being on our program on WITF. I think we could go on for hours, but why don't we sell a few books?